Hello, everybody. This is George Ann Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have with us Alex Hall. And you can email Alex at this address, alex@godfellas.org. That's alex@godfellas.org. And you can access the website, godfellas.org. And I know a lot of you out there have heard me talk how important it is to dig in and start learning about the church fathers and about church history. And Alex is going to talk to us today about the history of dogma. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Georgianne.
This is a very important topic.
Yes, I remember when we spoke a little while ago, you mentioned the idea of us having a discussion around church history.
Yes.
And it just so happens that I prepared this paper for the theological conference in Atlanta, Anthony's Theological Conference.
Yes.
And I thought it might be a good idea to go through some of that.
Okay, let's go.
Right, okay. The paper is actually written about the work of a very famous scholar called Adolf Harnack, who's a German guy. He lived between 1851 and 1931, so he lived a little while ago. But evangelicals widely hail him as being the prince of church history. So very highly respected leaders in the field of evangelicalism, some of their foremost thinkers, people like N.T. Wright, refer to him by that title, the Prince of Church History. So his work, even up to today, has a lot of credence among the so-called Orthodox camp. And so when we're talking about church history, when we're putting forward our ideas, it can lend a lot of weight to our point if we can offer some sort of, some sort of support from these respected figures. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. And this paper also, before I start sort of talking about, what's in this paper, it's available online. I've published it on my website, so that the website that you just mentioned, www.godfellas.org, it's on there. If you go to the history files section, then there's a couple of papers. There's one called A Close Run Thing, and then there's this history of dogma, which I've called The Radical Defamation. So a lot of people refer to, groups like the Socinians, the Biblical Unitarians, as being people who are trying to bring about in some way a radical reformation. But the belief that there is a need for a radical reformation is kind of based on the premise that at some stage things got deformed in order for them to have to be reformed back into their original shape. So this paper was really just attempting to set out the deforming process which the original pristine monotheism and kingdom gospel that Jesus preached and that his apostles, his chosen emissaries went on and propagated, the kind of twisting process which those truths underwent. And in actual fact, it was Harnack's mission in writing his history of dogma to actually trace the process by which the doctrine got changed. And he believed that since through the historical process, the doctrine got changed, by tracing that historical process, you're then able to untangle the strands and somehow get back to the original. So it would be like, a bit like, if you've got a tightly bound up ball of string that's so tangled up you can't make out which thread is which, that the process you'd need to get to in order to return the strings back would be to undo all the knots which have been tied up. And so he was dealing with quite a complex ball of historical knots and trying to undo it. And one of the sort of ways of expressing this that I used in the paper was Harnack's belief that you could use history to overcome history.
Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he could use the study of history to undo some damage which had been done by the historical process.
Yes.
And his History of Dogma was actually a vast work. It's spread out across seven volumes. It covers a vast period of church history. But what I focused on was volume one, which deals with the very earliest stages. I don't know if you've got any comments or anything, or should we just play on with this?
Go ahead.
Okay, right. One of the really striking comments that Harnack makes in his History of Dogma is concerning a document called Second Clement. Now, Second Clement is one of the earliest writings that we have from the Church after the last writings of the New Testament. There's actually a gap. There's a period of silence, which covers several years, between the last book of the New Testament and the first book by the writings of, as you referred to them earlier, the fathers. And so Second Clement is one of these very earliest books. But in Second Clement, there's something really quite striking, which Harnack then makes a comment on. The verse in Second Clement is in chapter 9. It's the fifth verse. It says, "If Christ the Lord who saved us, being first spirit, then became flesh, and so called us, in like manner also we in this flesh receive our reward." Now, if you're reading that, you could easily pass it over without really registering just how significant that clause is. I want to draw your attention to the bit that I kind of read with a bit more emphasis. It says that Christ the Lord was first spirit and then became flesh. So, in other words, before being a human being of flesh and blood like we are, he was first another kind of being, a being of spirit. Now, Harnack's comment on this clause is this. He says, "This is the fundamental theological and philosophical creed upon which the whole Trinitarian and Christological speculations of the Church of the succeeding centuries are built, and it is thus the root of the orthodox system of dogmatics." So he lays an enormous amount of stress on the significance of this short clause, because it is from that short clause, first of all beginning with a statement that Jesus was something other than a human being before his existence as a human being. It's from that that everything snowballs, and you eventually end up with the Council of Nicaea, the doctrine of the Trinity, the Council of Chalcedon, you know, the impersonal human nature. All that stuff kind of spirals as a natural consequence from this initial presupposition, which we find nowhere in the New Testament or the Hebrew Bible. We find it in these early writings shortly after the period when the apostles had died out.
And that, we're talking about time frame, about what year, the time frame.
Okay, there's two opinions currently prevailing about the dating of Second Clement. Either it was the work of Clement, who was Bishop of Rome, between 88 and 98 AD, which is really early. When we think about, you know, the destruction of the Jerusalem Temple that happened in AD 70, which is 18 years after the destruction of the Temple. So it was either him, 88 to 98 AD, or it was written by someone else under that name at around 140 to 160 AD. But either way, we're talking about a very, very early document. So even the latest dating, 140 to 160 AD, is very close to the lifetime of the apostles. And what's really really alarms me is the earliness, the rapid speed with which this alteration of the doctrine actually began to set in. So that's roughly when this Second Clement is supposed to have written his letter.
Okay.
Now, what Harnack does is he contrasts this idea that Jesus was first spirit, then became flesh, with what he himself refers to as, quote, the classic passage, unquote, in which he believes the original Jewish concept of the pre-existence of Jesus is to be found. This passage is 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 20. It's a, you know, text we're all very familiar with. Peter, the Jewish apostle chosen by Jesus, he called him the rock. He said, "On this rock I'll build my church." stated that he was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but has appeared in these last times for the sake of you. So the contrast there is between Clement saying that Jesus is a spirit being who became a flesh being, a spirit being who became a human being, and Peter, who says that he was a foreknown being. He was an individual who existed in the counsel, the plan and the purpose of God. God purposed a specific point in human history to raise up this man. And so before that, he existed in the plan of God. He existed in the promise of God, because God promised beforehand that this Savior was going to come. And then he appeared when he became a man, when he actually was created in the womb of Mary. So in Harnack's view, there's a sharp contrast. Something very, very major has happened between Peter, 1 Peter, and 2 Clement. And I've put a little footnote about the some further comments that Harnack makes regarding the contrast between the Hellenic or the Greek concept of preexistence and the Hebraic or Jewish one. Shall I read it out to you?
Yes.
Okay, what follows is a quote from the History of Dogma, Volume 1, page 318. It says, according to the theory held by the ancient Jews and by the whole of the Semitic nations. Now, just to make a quick point here, you know, anybody who's been listening to your shows for a period of time is going to know that, you know, what I'm saying here, but I'm going to say it again just for the sake of emphasis, in case this might be one of the first podcasts they're listening to. And this is that if we're going to believe in Jesus, if we're going to call ourselves Christians or disciples of Jesus, or, you know, whatever title we choose to own, we really need to try and understand what him and his Jewish apostles meant by the expressions that they used. And that involves recovering the Jewish mindset. So in other words, when Harnack's speaking about the Jewish and the ancient Jews and their way of looking at things, that's the way of looking at things that we need to recover if we want to be like Jesus, because Jesus was a Jew living among Jews, speaking in the Jewish language, using Jewish idioms of speech, and that the words that he used, whether he was speaking Aramaic or Hebrew or Greek, would have been interpreted in their Jewish sense. And what we don't want to do is think along Greek lines, because the Greek way of thinking was a way of thinking which had developed alongside the Jewish way of thinking, and the earliest church fathers were so influenced by that Greek way of thinking that it eclipsed their ability to be able to look at the Bible for what it was, for a Jewish book.
That's
and this process.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Alex.
Right, okay, thank you. It's actually a point that I won't lay claim to it myself. It's really the essence of Harnack's thesis.
Yes.
And as we go through this paper, we're going to see the outworking of this, how, you know, he really very clearly explains how this happened and provides a lot of detail. So anyway, going back to this quote from History of Dogma, page 318, the theory held by the ancient Jews and the whole of the Semitic nations, according to them, everything of real value that from time to time appears on earth has its existence in heaven. In other words, it exists with God. That is, God possesses a knowledge of it. So if the Jews spoke about something that exists in heaven, it would simply mean that God knows. It didn't necessarily mean that something had to physically exist. It's like when James says, every good gift comes down from heaven. You know, you could say, well, you know, I thank God for this meal. But it doesn't mean that the meal existed in heaven before it dropped down on earth.
Yes.
You're just acknowledging the fact that it's, you know, by virtue of God's grace that you've received that particular thing. And in the event of God's interventions with man, the main one being Jesus, it's acknowledging the fact that he existed in the mind of God. God planned this thing all along. It wasn't an afterthought. It wasn't a plan B. It wasn't something that God suddenly occurred to God one day.
Yes.
It was something which he intended to do all along.
Yes.
And so a lot of the pre-existence language, we might think to ourselves, well, why has God allowed this language, this pre-existent language, to crop up in the New Testament, knowing that people are going to get confused by it, knowing that Westerners like us will take it, in a sense, too literally, misunderstand it, and then begin to adopt the concept of a Jesus who existed as something other than a human being. Why did he allow that? And my view would be that If you look to the early history of the church, this isn't something Harnack covers, but this is something that, you know, it's a, if you like, it's a theory that I'm just putting out there for the listeners to see what they think of it. But it, there was the people who were elevating Jesus in a way that began to make him more than a man, and as we've touched on in some of our earlier conversations, by making Jesus more of a man, you somehow reduce the struggles that he went through and make his mission somehow less. But there were others who tried to underplay the divine initiative in the Jesus's life, and that they were called by the title adoptionists. I don't know if you've heard of the adoptionists before, but the adoptionists gained their title from the fact that they believed that Jesus of Nazareth wasn't marked out from the beginning to be God's chosen Messiah. It wasn't as if God had promised, you know, a specific person for a specific time, created that individual and raised him up and then anointed him with the Spirit and power at his baptism in order to go about doing, you know, his miraculous mission. The adoptionist said that God was waiting and he was observing humanity, he was watching human history unfold, and he was just waiting for the right person to come along. And when the right person came along, God recognized the virtue of that person, that that person was different and special, they were better than all the other people around them. That person happened to be Jesus. And then God, at his baptism, at Jesus' baptism, when he poured out the Spirit upon him, what he actually did was he adopted Jesus as his son. And there's a very big difference between believing that, you know, God was responding to the initiative on the part of Jesus, but, you know, because of his virtue, and then adopted him as son, than to say no, that from the very beginning God created a son inside Mary, and that the you know, God the Father was literally Jesus' father. And so the adoptionist error is really countered by the language of pre-existence. So it's not something that just happens to be there in the Bible. It's not something that was allowed to remain there in order to confuse people or to trip them up. But in fact, it played a very significant role in the earliest theological debates in providing the church of a witness to the fact that Jesus was created by God for a specific purpose. He was chosen by God before he was created. He was chosen by God before the foundation of the world, that he was going to be the Messiah, he was going to be the chosen one, and he was going to be the Savior. It wasn't God's responding to an initiative which had come up from among men. It was God's initiative all along. It was God's saving plan and unfolding. And so I believe the pre-existence language is there to counter this tendency towards adoptionism. So I'm going back to the quote, and I keep getting sidetracked from this. History of Dogma, page 318. Everything in heaven is so in the sense that God possesses a knowledge of it, and for that reason has a real being. The old Jewish theory of pre-existence is founded on the religious idea of the omniscience, or the all-knowingness of, and omnipotence, in other words, the all-powerfulness of God, that God to whom the events of history do not come as a surprise, but who guides their course. He guides their course. When God predicts the future, it isn't that he's got a telescopic foresight and he's seen what's going to happen, but it is that he orchestrates history and he guides it. So when he prophesies about future events, it is actually he's declaring a purpose which he is then going to guide history towards. And it's exactly the same in the case of Jesus. When God spoke through the prophets, telling you know, about them about the Messiah, it wasn't that he could see this virtuous man who was going to rise up and then God was going to respond to that by adopting him. It was God's declaring what he was planning to do, the man that he was planning to raise up. And then, by contrast to the Jewish view, the next page, 319, Harnack says, according to the Hellenic is another word for Greek, the Hellenic conception, which has become associated with Platonism, the idea of pre-existence is independent of the idea of God. It is based on the conception of the contrast between spirit and matter. See the thing there in Clement, spirit and matter?
Yes.
First spirit, then became flesh. Between infinite and finite, found in the cosmos itself. In the case of all spiritual things, life in the body or flesh is at bottom an inadequate and unsuitable condition, for the spirit is eternal, the flesh is perishable. There's without going too far into it, there's a dualism there. There's a contempt for the material world. There's a view that somehow manhood is unworthy of God's Messiah. He had to be more. He had to be spirit as well. Spirit being understood as that which was real, really real, or permanent, or good. So they weren't comfortable with this idea that Jesus was just a man. As if, by just a man, I think somebody uses the term just a man, they're massively underestimating what manhood is in God's eyes. They're taking a low view of it, which comes from Greek philosophy, that the Hebraic view of man's, of what God has chosen man to be is actually quite high and lofty. So anyway, that's just his initial thing. That's his initial quote on 2 Clement 9:5, which is the earliest instance he can find of this other view beginning to creep in. And is it the cuckoo? I think there's a bird, I think it's a cuckoo. It will come into the nest of another bird, and it will, I don't know if it bullies the bird out of the nest or it just kind of creeps in there when the bird's off flying around the place. But it lays its own egg there. Huh. Have you ever heard this story?
No.
This is a deep one. This happens in nature, I think. I'm pretty sure it really happens. It's not just one of them, stories that circulate. So it lays its egg there, slyly, and then it creeps off. And the main bird comes along, back to its own nest, and it just sees the egg there, but it doesn't realize that, like the parable of the wheat and the tares, an enemy has laid its egg there.
Yes.
So it begins to raise up this egg which isn't its own.
Yes.
And the cuckoo's off minding its business now. The cuckoo's done. This other bird is now raising the cuckoo's egg for it.
That's pretty good.
It's neat. But then something bad happens. The cuckoo, what's the word for a chick, isn't it, yeah? The cuckoo chick is tougher than other chicks, and it's the first one out of the egg. And then what that cuckoo chick begins to do is to boot out the other eggs. And so it will smash the other eggs, and it will demand all the food and all the attention, and it will either murder or contrive to sort of starve the other chicks. And so the bird is just bringing food to this chick, which is growing faster than all the other chicks, until eventually the only chick left is the cuckoo chick. And this bird is raising up a chick which does not belong to it, and that chick has actually killed all the other chicks.
Yeah, it sounds like human society.
And you see this pattern repeated again and again.
Yes.
And I think it sort of fits this pattern of the Greek kind of view, which got implanted in the church. And here in 2 Clement 9:5, it's just there in a seed form. It's a drop in the ocean. You've got this throwaway line in the midst of the whole of the New Testament and the Hebrew Bible, this really strong tradition of Jewish monotheism, this expectation of the kingdom, this human Messiah, but then it begins to grow and grow and grow until eventually it stifles the original view. And sadly, the church, the Gentile church, with the best intentions in the world, possibly, I mean, this is something that I kind of venture to suggest towards the end of the paper, intending to safeguard the faith, intending to please God, actually ended up feeding this thing which killed off the original view, to the point that in later generations, those who advocated it were branded as heretics and many of them brutally murdered.
Yes, there was a lot of people murdered over this. Yes.
And it's almost like, I don't know, it sounds a bit absurd to say it this way, but Satan's cuckoo. And those martyrs for the faith, those witnesses to the faith, were really just trying to stick up for the original truth, which, got kicked out of the nest.
Wow.
So I think this is a little sort of picture, I suppose, to drop into the minds of the hearers, to describe this process which began. So you might think, what's the big fuss? Why is Alex going on about this little verse? Or not me, but Harnack, why is Harnack making such a big deal out of it? Because Harnack tried to look back to the point when the cuckoo first got in the nest. And he located it here, in 2 Clement. And that's why he attaches so much importance to it. Because the rest of his history of dogma is an outworking of the results of that initial infiltration. So there you have it, the classic passage in 1 Peter 1:20. That's the one we really need to get our heads around whenever we're looking at the language of pre-existence. He was foreknown before the foundation of the world. And a little comment of mine, which I think is important to make, and which I make in the paper here, is that when we talk about pre-existence, we're really not talking about whether or not Jesus pre-existed. I can agree with a Trinitarian, I can agree with a Jehovah's Witness or Arian, to say, yeah, Jesus pre-existed, of course he did. You know, the Bible spoke about him before he was born. You know, the Bible even describes him as being slain before the foundation of the world.
Yes.
The issue at stake is, what type of existence was it? Did he exist as a spirit being? Did he exist as God the Son, the second person of the Trinity? Or did he exist as an idea in the mind of God? Now, nobody would seriously suggest that he was physically slain before the foundation of the world. If anyone is going to interpret that saying will say, no, it was God planned for him to be slain. Well, if it's okay for him to have been slain in the sense that he was planned, why can't you just attribute the plan of God to all other aspects of his existence? And then you don't have these terrible conundrums and puzzles around how authentic his humanity is, or his growth, his spiritual development. And so the key words, for those of you that like a bit of Greek, the key words in 1 Peter are prognosmenos. We know we talk about prognosticating.
Yes.
When we're talking about the future, I think it comes from this Greek word, prognosmenos and phanerothes. I always do apologize when I try and quote foreign languages. I probably just murdered those two words. But the prognosmenos bit is God's foreknowing, and the phanerothes is the appearing, the causing Jesus to appear. So the birth of the Messiah was a transition from being foreknown by God to being made known to men. Foreknown by God before his creation inside Mary and his birth, and then after that he was made known to men. And Harnack says the Jewish and Greek views of this are as wide apart as the poles. And that quote's taken from, The History of Dogma, Volume 1, I think page 138. So, is there any comments or questions before we move on to the next bit?
No, keep going. This is very interesting.
Okay. There's a few, consequences or conclusions which Harnack draws from having this conception that Jesus existed as a spirit being before he was born. And he spells them out. They're things which I very much share, a point of view which I very much share. But, you know, who am I? People aren't necessarily going to listen to you, Georgiana, if you start running around quoting me. They're going to say, I don't know who the guy is. I don't know if he knows what he's talking about. So I'm going to give it to you from Harnack.
Okay.
And, all these scholars respect Harnack. So if you tell them Harnack said so, they should at least be open, a little bit more open than if you say Alex said so. So Harnack says that one of the consequences of this view is that it threatens the monarchy, and by monarchy he means the supremacy of God, because now you've got another contender alongside God. And then we see this reaches its peak when it actually results in setting up another person within the Godhead, within, that category of God. And the other one is that it results in a naive docetism. Okay, so I'm just going to define docetism for the benefit of the hearers, because it's a bit of a technical theological term. Someone might not be familiar with it. It comes from the Greek word dokeo, which means to seem or to appear. And docetism is the belief that Jesus' physical body was an illusion. In other words, Jesus only seemed to be physical. Again, it goes back to this dualistic view, which is very uncomfortable with the idea of God's Savior being a flesh and blood human being. They said, no, he just appeared that way. And there's some of the Gnostic legends was that when Jesus was walking, if you look carefully at his feet, he didn't leave behind a footprint. All these sort of views that just trying to separate Jesus from the rest of us, because they just weren't comfortable with the idea of the Messiah, being a material human being like the rest of us. In reality, they say he was an incorporeal, pure spirit. I don't need to go too far into that. Oh, I'm going to go a bit further. Docetism could be further explained as the view that because the human body is temporary and the spirit is eternal, the body of Jesus therefore must have been an illusion, and his crucifixion must have been an illusion as well.
My goodness.
Yeah. And when you think about Muhammad in his travels, going back to our discussions about Islam, he came across a lot of different Christian sects. And some of the Gnostic writings put forward this view. I think one of them, I might be wrong about this, is the Apocalypse of Peter, which has somebody being crucified in Jesus' place while Jesus stands on a mountain and laughs and says, look, they think they're crucifying me, you know, and I'm here with you guys, you know, standing with Peter. Now, the idea of Jesus laughing at a man being crucified in itself seems very different to the Jesus, you know, this compassionate man, which the Gospels set out. But it might have been that it was in these Gnostic encounters that Muhammad first got the idea that Jesus wasn't actually crucified, and then he went on and sort of, you know, kind of spoke it out in the recital of the Quran. Just an idea there. But certainly we have a very similar view in Islam, and they like to quote the Gnostic Gospels in support of that view. So, saying that the human body is temporary has a tendency to undercut the importance of the belief in the resurrection of the dead and the goodness of created matter. When God created the world, he declared that it was good. Repeatedly, in fact, he does so. And so for us to denigrate the material realm is to denigrate God's handiwork. It's to say that something is evil which God has declared to be good. And we don't really want to do that, do we?
Well, it was good until Satan screwed it up.
Well, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And then at some point, you know, God said men's hearts are continually evil, and he destroyed the world.
Yeah.
And he's getting ready to do it again.
That's right, yeah. And yet, there's a distinction to be made, isn't there? The world itself is still every bit as amazing in the way that it reflects God's power, his artistry, his wisdom, the laws of nature, you know, the laws of physics, the balance of the ecosystem, just the sheer beauty of nature tells us that it's still a good creation. It's rather like a hijack.
Yes.
If someone hijacks the aeroplane is still an aeroplane. It still flies. The instruments still obey the commands of the pilot. But it's been sent off course. Something evil has taken hold of that aeroplane and is, you know, putting it in the wrong direction.
That's right.
But all you have to do is remove the hijacker, put a good pilot back in the controls, and immediately that same aeroplane is back on course. It's doing what it was designed to do. And I see the creation in that way. We see so much suffering, so much wickedness. You can almost understand how some of these Greek philosophers threw up their hands and said, no, this cannot have been created by a good God. You know, this creation must be... There's something evil, something terribly wrong has happened. And they're right. But what they didn't have was the narrative. They didn't have the actual narrative of mankind's disobedience and our estrangement from God, which allows you to hold the beauty and the goodness of the creation in one hand and the evil that goes on in the world in the other, and be able to reconcile the two and understand the relationship between the two.
That's a good point.
And so dualism was an inability to do that, so they just kind of... They couldn't hold the two together. They didn't have a narrative that was strong enough to be able to reconcile this incredible tension, this paradox we see. We even see it in ourselves. We see it in human beings. How can a human being... Just look at the events on September the 11th, where you had people who were willing to sacrifice everything to take people's lives. And yet human beings were running towards those buildings, putting themselves in harm's way to try and save someone. You wouldn't think it was the same race of humanity, would you?
Yeah, the same species.
You wouldn't think it's the same species. You think one of them must be alien to the other, but no, they're not. This dividing line between the good and the evil, it doesn't run between material and spiritual. It runs right down the middle of every one of us. We see it in ourselves. And so it's actually, I don't know if you call it a cosmological or anthropological sort of issue here. But anyway, I believe the Bible encourages us to believe in the goodness of created matter. And naturally from that is the resurrection of the dead. That, you know, we're not going to float away our spiritual pure soul imprisoned in this body is going to float away and go to be somewhere else, which is better. No, we believe God's going to redeem the whole lot. In Romans 8, the entire creation will be redeemed, including our bodies, including planet Earth, and restored back to not just what it was originally intended, not back to what it was in the beginning, but to what it was intended to be from the beginning, which is a mature humanity over a populated planet over which man has taken dominion and subdued it and is governing it wisely. So I'm getting off track here, George M.
Okay.
I have a tendency to get carried away. Well, sometimes you might have to put me in check a little bit. So yeah, you've got this naive docetism, this view that Jesus wasn't really, he only appeared to be human. But if you traced him back to the moment before he was born, he already existed. None of us, the rest of us did. So straight away, he's different from us. The naive docetism stems from, and I'm quoting Harnack again, the flesh of Jesus, that is the human nature created by God, appears depreciated because it was reckoned as something unsuitable for Christ and foreign to him as a spiritual being. Does that make sense? It's a bit like saying that if I was to dress you up in an Elvis Presley jumpsuit, and it doesn't really suit you, it isn't really fitting to your style, your persona, you know, unless you're an Elvis impersonator, in which case, you know, that would be fine. But it's just not fitting. And it makes out the human nature to be something that wasn't suitable for Jesus.
Yeah.
When in fact we know that it was as a man that he was raised up, because by man came sin, by man comes obedience, by man came death, by man comes the resurrection from the dead. All these parallels that writers like Paul draw. So in actual fact, the human nature was very much suitable to him. Why? Because he was on a mission to save humanity. Human nature was very suitable to Jesus. Why? Because mankind had been given dominion over planet Earth, and if mankind wasn't doing it right, God would have to raise up another man to fix it. So he had to be a human being. And it also, what's more, it contradicts the synoptic birth narratives, the stories about the birth of Jesus which we have in the Gospels. Matthew, Mark and Luke. Harnack says about this, and I'm quoting again, "The miraculous genesis of Christ in the Virgin by the Holy Spirit and the real pre-existence," by which he means the Greek pre-existence, "are of course mutually exclusive." So no matter how much theologians might weep and wail and say, no, you can have both, you can have a genuine virginal conception, you can have him being the Son of God because of his virginal birth in Mary, and at the same time, he can be the Son of God pre-existing with the Father, you know, before his birth. According to Harnack, those two beliefs are mutually exclusive. You have to choose. Either he was a genuine, authentic human being conceived in Mary, or he was a spirit being, first spirit, who then became flesh, in the words of 2 Clement 9:5.
Where did he get his spirit?
Right.
What force animated him?
Yeah.
You know, see, that's the little puzzle there.
Mm.
You know, his spirit had to exist somehow. I mean, God can do whatever God wants to do.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He's never done it again.
Yeah.
You know, there is no other beside, you know, Jesus. He's never brought another Savior to the world.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
That one.
That what you've done there, George, and you've raised up this another inescapable question. You cannot get around this question. If God is the Father, described as Father, and Jesus is described as Son, every son originates from his Father, and no son exists, you know, begins at the same time as his Father. If we wanted to describe that relationship, or rather if the Bible had wanted to describe the relationship between Jesus and God in those terms, there's a very simple term they could have used. Do you know what they could have used?
What?
If we have two people that are born at the same time, in the same way, what do we call them?
Twins.
Twins. It would be the twins, if you had of God the twin and God the other twin. Born simultaneously. Or if, you know, they don't have a beginning, then, you know, they're twins in the sense that they're both beginningless. They're the two beginningless beings. But as you said, at some point, this father begat a son. Even if you don't want to say it happened in Mary, which you should, because the Bible says it happened in Mary. But even if someone doesn't want to say it happened in Mary, it had to happen at some point. And so that, you know, the Son that it originates with the Father, comes after the Father, for those words to have any sense at all. And yeah, Harnack later makes this quote. Just going to finish off the quote, but he says that the miraculous Genesis and the real preexistence are mutually exclusive. He then says, at a later period, it is true, it became necessary to unite them in thought. So having said they're mutually exclusive, he then says that later on they were united in thought, but the implication clearly is that it was some sort of a shotgun marriage. It was some sort of a, you know, a forced union of two incompatible, characteristics or viewpoints. So, that's really the introduction part, the first sort of point, which I felt was the most important point of the whole book. And as Harnack himself sees it as being the fountainhead, I thought I'd begin my coverage of this survey of the history of dogma with that particular quote. Now, we actually see this tension between the two views, which these theologians from that point on were trying to hold together and struggling to do so.
Yeah.
The tension actually becomes explicit later on. Justin, he had to actually change the formula which he used to describe the birth of Jesus. The Greek word ek means of or from, yeah? We would understand Jesus as being born ek Mary. He was born of Mary. He was born from Mary. Mary was his kind of source, where he stemmed from. Because he was created somewhere inside Mary, and he came out into the world from Mary, didn't he? But Justin wasn't comfortable with that, and he had to actually use a different Greek word to describe Jesus. He says that Jesus came through Mary, or dia Mary. So Mary was now a pipeline. Now, Justin would have been perfectly comfortable to say that you, Georgianne, came from your mother or of your mother. But he wasn't happy to say that about Jesus. For him, Mary was just a temporary point which Jesus passed through, from being a spirit being to being a human being. So I've kind of paraphrased this in my paper. I said he's a visitor from the outside passing through the human race. He's not one of us. He's an alien. He's a visitor. He's coming through. And then just another quote. The main features of the message concerning Christ of the matter of the evangelic history were fixed in the first and second generations of believers and on Palestinian soil. But yet, up to the middle of the second century, this matter was in many ways increased in Gentile Christian regions. At the beginning of the second century, the old tradition was recast or rejected. So something big happened as it moved from Palestinian soil in the hands of Jews to the wider regions in the hand of Gentiles. And the old tradition underwent a radical, to use the term I'm using, deformation. And next I kind of look to the process by which this took place. Have we got time to just delve into this a little bit?
Yes.
Okay. My question as I was studying the history of dogmas to say, how did this happen? How in the world did this revolution take place in such a short span of time? At the beginning of the second century here, according to Harnack. The big problem with this is that the period between the last, you know, the writing of the last books of the New Testament and this earliest period of the Fathers, between that short period of years, it's actually from about the year 61 to the beginning of the reign of Trajan, which would be in 98. So you're talking about a period of some, 37 years? Those 37 years are shrouded in mystery. Harnack says, there may well be, I'll quote you directly, we possess probably not a few writings which belong to that period, but how are we to prove this? How are they to be arranged? So it's not to say that we don't have documents from that intervening period, but we just can't be sure which ones come from which particular date. So it seems as if, there's a quote which I heard, I don't know where it's from, that it's as if a curtain falls on the close of the writing of the New Testament. And when the curtain lifts again, 37 years later, the church looks completely different. The beliefs of the church have really begun to change. In the fact that this period is shrouded in mystery, Harnack says, and I'm quoting again, "Here lies the cause of most of the differences, combinations, and uncertainties. Many scholars therefore actually leave these 40 years out of account and seek to place everything in the first three decennia of the second century. Nevertheless, in spite of this," sorry, this is me writing now, "nevertheless, in spite of this, there are some clear milestones, matters which were undoubtedly of great consequence in bringing about the Christological developments, which were already well underway by the time 2 Clement 9:5 made its abrupt appearance." Okay, the first milestone that I want to draw your attention to is the church made a break with the synagogue. Initially, if you look at the way that the church is described in the book of Acts, it's described as being, I think, the sect of the Nazarene. It was seen as being another sect within Judaism. It's just another branch. So you'd have Pharisaic Judaism, you'd have the Judaism of the Essenes, the Judaism of the Sadducees, and now you have the Judaism of Jesus. So it was seen as being coexisting. And you read again in the book of Acts that the apostles would attend the temple, and when Paul would ever visit a town, he would always go into the synagogue and begin to speak. So it was very much still rooted and grounded in the Jewish life of the synagogue and the Jewish community. However, what began to happen was there was an increasing hostility, and again we can trace this in the book of Acts, where whenever there's trouble for the preachers of the gospel in the book of Acts, it's nearly always the Jewish authorities which are stirring it up. This is something which extends beyond the Jerusalem and Judea. It actually takes place in Asia Minor, modern day Turkey, as far afield as that, where the Jewish community, the Jewish diaspora in those towns, actually stir up the animosity of locals against the preachers of the gospel. And so there was a lot of persecution which took place. And there's a few significant events which kind of contributed towards the eventual permanent separation of the church from the synagogue, to the point that now you don't get people who practice Judaism coming to churches, do you?
No.
And you don't get Christians going to synagogue.
Right.
And the two things have been completely distinct. Whereas in the book of Acts, if you want to follow a bunch of Jewish Christians to quote-unquote church, you probably would have ended up sitting in the synagogue. And they would have heard the Torah, but their way of believing that Torah, their way of practicing their faith, would have been different from the other Jews. But there was a much more of a union. So why did the church leave? One of the first reasons for the break was this persecution which they underwent. Now, you've heard of the historian Flavius Josephus, yeah?
Yes.
Right, in Jewish Antiquities 20, pages 197 to 203, Josephus wrote between 37 and 100 AD. He recorded in Jewish Antiquities that in 62 AD, which is an event which happened in his lifetime, a prominent leader of the Christian community in Jerusalem was killed, along with several others, by a group of Jews at the instigation of the high priest Annas. The act resulted in his being deposed by King Agrippa, but Josephus tells us that this person who was killed by the high priest Annas was none other than James, the brother of Jesus. So this after killing Jesus, this next priest actually kills James, the brother of Jesus. This kind of intimidated the church around Jerusalem, the Palestinian Christian Jewish community. And it led to a gradual slowing down of their evangelism among the Jews. And so while the opposition was really beginning to heat up on their home ground, on around Jerusalem and Judea, something simultaneously was beginning to happen in the borders beyond the Jewish territories. And this again, if we go to the book of Acts, we can find all this sort of stuff recorded there. What was happening is the gospel was spreading like wildfire among the Gentiles. And so you have the gradual suppression of the gospel on its home soil and by the people to whom you know, the oracles were first committed. Remember, Jesus himself said that I haven't come back to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. It's only subsequent to his resurrection, he says, now go out, you know, to all nations, preach the gospel to every nation, and go in the words that he's quoted as saying in the book of Acts, to Jerusalem, Judea, to Samaria, to the uttermost parts of the earth. And what began to happen was, it began to get suppressed around Jerusalem and Judea, and grow in the Gentile regions, and really caught on among the Gentiles in a big way. And then what happened, the next big step, was in AD 70, Titus destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. And this did more than just remove a common ground where the Jews and Jewish Christians would meet up. It actually resulted in the Jews being expelled from the city, because they were the ones that had rebelled against the Roman authorities. But the Christians, following Jesus' advice in the Sermon on the Mount, had been turning the other cheek. They had been, rendering blessing in exchange for cursing. And so they weren't really seen as being troublemakers by the Jewish authorities. So they kicked the Jews out, but the Jewish Christians, because of their different stance, were allowed to remain in Jerusalem. And so again, that brought about a physical, geographical separation between the two camps. And the Jewish leadership, having been uprooted, Talmudic tradition tells us that the Emperor Vespasian, a while before that, had given permission to a guy called Yohanan ben Zakkai to establish a yeshiva in a place called Jabna to the west of the city of Jamnia. And so they already had this existing base, this existing kind of school and community. And so when they got kicked out of Jerusalem, that's where they went to. They had like a second base of operations. And it is there, that is really the hotbed of where Talmudic Judaism has its origins and really began to grow up. Now by 80 AD, just 10 years later, this yeshiva formally instituted the Birchat HaMinim, which was a curse. Minim would be the equivalent of sectarians. And it's a veiled language with which they described the Christians. They called them sectarians. So again, even at that point, it wasn't seen as being a separate religion. It was seen as being a sect within Judaism, that the orthodoxy of Talmudic Judaism, the Sanhedrin, and this yeshiva, which was at the capital of Judaism, it was being anathematized by them. So it was a curse that was pronounced upon the sectarians, a curse that was pronounced upon the Christians, contained in the 18 benedictions, which were to be recited as part of the synagogue service. And do you know why they made that curse, Georgiane?
Why?
Imagine you wanted to join a particular group because you thought that by being among them and worshipping with them, you could have an influence on their beliefs. Imagine you're in that situation, Georgiane. And it comes to the attention of the leadership that Georgiane is here, and she's worshipping with us. She's worshipping, according to her, the same God as us. She believes the same scriptures as us. You know, she's perfectly free to join in, and she's comfortable worshipping with us. But now as leaders, we're afraid that Georgiane is going to begin to influence other people. And we can actually begin that people see that people are beginning to follow her and adopt her point of view. So what do we do to make Georgiane feel uncomfortable?
Stone me.
We could do that. We could get some big ushers at the door of the church, like bouncers, to physically kick you out. But they were much more subtle than that. What they did was they said, let's include, as part of the service, as part of the prayers that people recite, a curse upon the Christians.
Okay.
Because no one's going to come into the midst of the kingdom and then call a curse down upon themselves.
How silly.
Yeah. So that's what they did. And so it wasn't so much a question of the Christians just picking up themselves and becoming anti-Semitic. Because remember, at this stage, the majority of them are still Jews,
yeah,
anyway. So it's not that they're going to disown their own heritage or feel unwelcome, you know, among their own people. It was actually the fact that it was more that they were forced out. Because they couldn't stand in the midst of the congregation. And the leadership was actually told, look to see who doesn't pronounce the benediction. If they don't pronounce Birchat HaMinim, if they won't curse the sectarians, then immediately the finger of suspicion falls on that individual.
See, This is a big issue with me, Alex. You know, we have what as Anthony said, you know, over 30,000 different things that wear the label of Christian.
Yeah.
And they're still in kindergarten. They're still picking their nose and pointing their fingers at people.
Yeah.
It is absolutely disgusting. It is sickening.
Yeah, it is. It is.
When are they ever going to grow up?
Yeah.
You know? Oh.
If we just began talking to each other, you know, if we could just drop some of the name calling, some of the labels, and have a dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, that would be progress in itself.
Sure.
And I don't see how anyone thinks that God is pleased with a finger pointing or a name calling attitude or an attitude that refuses to dialogue.
Yeah, or people that go out and burn people as witches.
You know?
I mean, there is something in the human race that is just, you know, they just don't have all their oars in the water. Their lust is out of plumb, I'm telling you.
Absolutely.
And after thousands of years, it has never changed.
No.
You know, it's just like when God was their leader, the leader of the Israelites. Wasn't good enough. The idiot people wanted a king like their pagan neighbors had. Look what we've got today. We've got the earth just covered up with kings. You know, they're corporate CEOs and they're presidents of countries. They're all kings. And look at the mess the world is in.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it's just... What is, I mean, the human race is a bunch of screwballs. You know? I mean,
For all the technological advancement, for all the changes in fashions and language and ways of living, and for all the wonderful, you know, art and culture that humanity has produced, Solomon summed it up when he said, "There's nothing new under the sun."
Yeah.
It's still, if you try and look at us morally, if you try and look at our systems of government, if you try and look for justice in society, you realize that no progress has been made whatsoever.
That's right. You look at justice, it is so corrupt.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, why does that gal wear that bandana around her eyes? Justice is blind. You bet it is. You bet it's blind.
Yeah. I don't think that's the blindness they intended it to have.
No, Alex, I mean, justice is, if you've got a lot of money and you're, connected well, you've got your justice. But if you're just a common person, forget it.
Yeah.
And there's no mercy. There's no common sense.
Yeah.
You know, it's just,
it's a sad situation.
You betcha.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, there's so much optimism throughout the period of the Enlightenment when they began to say, you know, we don't really need God anymore because through science we're actually finding the mechanisms by which the world works without having to explain it by saying it's miraculous or it's God that causes the sun to rise and set. So they began to, by identifying these natural processes, which God had set in motion in the first place.
Amen.
They thought that they had actually painted God out of the picture.
Yes.
I think Nietzsche said, you know, God is dead and we killed him. We made so many discoveries that there's no room left for God. There's no room left for mystery. This is what they thought. And they just saw the progress. As mankind gained scientific knowledge and removed superstition, which is what they saw all forms of religion as being, got that out of the picture, religion stopped controlling things so much, then human society was going to progress and we were going to have a fair and a just society. It was going to be more equal. Wealth was going to be distributed. People were going to be healthier. They're going to live longer. You know, no longer going to see these plagues of war and starvation and genocide.
War is very lucrative.
It is,
And if it weren't lucrative, men are so lazy, they wouldn't do it.
Putin wouldn't get up.
I'm serious.
That's right.
And look what they've done to the food with the genetic modifications. Look what they're doing to animals.
Yeah.
Look what they're doing to the water, pumping sewage back into the aquifers.
Yeah.
And look what they're doing in the air with these chemtrails. I mean, we're dealing with some real fallen people.
Yeah, and that's the problem. And that's, in fact, if you study the historical process, that's what happened. After the Enlightenment, at the peak of the Enlightenment...
Alex, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know, you see, we've been through this before at the Tower of Babel.
Right, yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
We're at that point, I think, very close to it again. And God is not going to put up with it much longer.
No. No. So, yeah, something's going to have to happen. Something's going to have to give.
Yeah, let their science save them. Ha, ha, ha.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's what the thing that they by the time you reach the 20th century, what they were expecting was this big peak, this big breakthrough point.
Yeah.
And what we actually had with the 20th century was the most amount of wars that human history has ever seen.
Yes.
The most amount of people dying of wars that human history has ever seen. We had genocides. We had the, you know, genocides in Armenia. We had the Nazi Holocaust.
Yes.
We had Stalin killing more of his own people than Hitler killed in the war. We had Pol Pot decimating Cambodia. We've had... You know, atrocity upon atrocity. You know, the Cultural Revolution, millions of people dying in China. We could look across the world. We've had two entire cities destroyed with atomic bombs.
Yeah.
An endless litany of atrocities on every single level. And as you said, the pollution, you know, the abuse of animals, all in this 20th century, which is supposed to have been the apex of the Enlightenment. With all these discoveries, all this progress, why aren't we doing better? Why are we doing worse? Well, it's because these scientific discoveries which we thought were going to liberate us by empowering us, in actual fact, only empowered us to be even better at destroying one another.
Yes.
And really bring into fruition the evil and the darkness which is inside us. Mm. And so, in fact, progress, which is progress, has taken us back.
Alex, we're right at the top of the hour.
Right,
yes.
Let's
pick this up in a part two.
Let's do that. Yeah.
This is really good stuff.
Okay, we're having some other discussions, but it's I think it's all valuable to explore, isn't it?
You betcha it is.
Yeah.
You know, and when you look at this New World Order, their blueprint is Plato.
Right, okay.
You know, it's just more insanity from the fallen nature of mankind.
Right.
Well, we will be back with Alex real soon, and we may just go ahead and make a series out of this because it is important and, very pertinent for today. So you can go to Alex's website. It's godfellas.org. You can email Alex at this address, alex@godfellas.org. And God bless every one of you out there that's listening. You know, dig in. Learn about the church fathers. Learn about church history. It is very enlightening. And I want to thank you, Alex, so much.
Thank you, Georgiana. I really enjoyed these conversations.
Me too. Me too. Okay, this is Georgiana Hughes with Alex Hall signing off, and we will be back with part two. God bless you for listening. Good night, everybody.